You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. At the dawn of the 19th century, a regional leader rose to prominence with a progressive and imaginative vision for what Michigan could become, but which was not to be. He was known as one of the great statesmen and military commanders of his age, the Shawnee Chief Tecumseh. A new biography brings him to us in greater detail and also brings a new appreciation for Tecumseh's brother, Tenskwatawa, a spiritual leader who was referred to as the Prophet. These two brothers were ahead of their time on issues of Native sovereignty and Native identity. Author, historian, and former diplomat Peter Cozens joins us now. He's the author of Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. Peter, welcome to Stateside.
My pleasure, and thank you for the invitation.
Peter, some of your past books have explored aspects of the American Civil War and the wars against the United States and indigenous nations on the Western Plains. Can you tell us about why this history of what was going on in the Old Northwest and these two brothers, why this history was important to you?
It was important to me because I realized that after writing my book on the Indian Wars in the West, had things gone differently in the Old Northwest, that is to say, had Tecumseh and his brother prevailed against encroaching Americans with British assistance, and there was every possibility that they might have. It was not a foregone conclusion that they were going to lose. If they had prevailed, then the shape of both the Midwest and the American West may have been radically changed. At a minimum, the American movement west of the Mississippi River to settle the American West would have been retarded significantly by one, two, maybe even three generations.
Yeah. I mean, this period was the childhood of the United States, but at the same time, an extremely aggressive place in the colonization of North America. And you note that in these years, maybe the most critical intergovernmental relationships that the U.S. had were maybe not with the U.K. or France, but with Native nations. Can you say more about why that was?
Exactly, because at the time the Revolutionary War ended, the nascent United States was really limited to the Atlantic seaboard and with some tentative settlements in modern-day Kentucky. And it was absolutely imperative that the United States, if it were to grow and prosper, that it break free of the Atlantic seaboard and move west to the Appalachian Mountains, in large part to allow for the growing population along the Atlantic seaboard. And, of course, the area west of the Appalachians was under the control, was owned by American Indian tribes. And consequently, diplomacy with them was critical if the United States were to grow and have any chance of really prospering as a nation.
Yeah. Here in the Great Lakes regions, Tecumseh's name is fairly well known. There's, of course, a town in Michigan that's named after him, although around here we say Tecumseh. The name of his brother, Tenskwatawa, is somewhat less well known. The brothers were Shawnee, but as you write, the Shawnee were deeply splintered by this point, and that was reflected in the brothers' childhood. Their father had been killed when they were both pretty young, and the brothers moved around, first with their mother and then on their own, frequently with and within other tribes. Can you say, first of all, what had disrupted tribal life at that stage?
Tribal life was disrupted very early on in Tecumseh's life and Tenskwatawa, his younger brother's life. The initial upset came from the settlement of Kentucky and pressure by Kentuckians to push north of the Ohio River, and also efforts by the Shawnee and their allied tribes to drive the Kentuckians out of Kentucky, out of what is modern Kentucky, because that was prime hunting ground for these tribes, and they claimed it as their own. So that was the initial source of upset. And as the United States began to flex its muscle after the Revolutionary War, and settlers began pouring into the Ohio Valley by way of the Ohio River, there were constant efforts by the Indians to disrupt, of course, this what the whites would call settlement, what the Indians would refer to as an invasion of their homelands. Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa, neither one of them really ever enjoyed a stable normal childhood. They were, as you say, constantly being uprooted by raids launched by the Kentucky militia or by other American, you know, American forces in the area. Yeah. So they were constantly being pushed deeper into Ohio and saw their lands shrinking and saw their tribe splintered. In fact, very early on in their lives, nearly half the Shawnee, 2,000 Shawnee as a total population, about half the Shawnee decided that they did not want to fight and preferred to accept a Spanish land grant west of Mississippi in modern Missouri. And their mother was among those who decided to move, leaving behind her two sons with her eldest daughter. So they had a number of disruptions early on.
Yeah. You take some pains in the book to explain that moving around in and of itself was a part of Shawnee life, but this was something very different. How do you see Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa being shaped by that experience of living outside a traditional tribal structure and relationships and, you know, maybe just living on the run and living under this threat all the time?
Well, I think it made them long for a sense of normalcy. I think we see that in Tenskwatawa's doctrine, which really was the foundation of the Pan-Indian Alliance that Tecumseh eventually came to dominate, never really replaced his brother. That is Tenskwatawa's call for spiritual and cultural rebirth on the part of the tribes of the Great Lakes region as sort of a precursor to a revitalization of their cultures and way of life, which was being shattered by the American presence and the influence of alcohol and American encroachment. So that manifested itself, I think, in part in Tenskwatawa's, you know, call for spiritual unity, and then, of course, all the more clearly in Tecumseh's call for political unity among the tribes, for the tribes to stop negotiating semi-legitimate treaties piecemeal with the American government and rather unite and look at all the remaining land that they possess in the Midwest as being theirs in common, not to be negotiated away in part by any single tribe or portions of tribe, but to be considered land held in common. So I think a sense of a desire to return to have some kind of a sense of normalcy and permanence pervaded both their beliefs.
Did you get much of a sense through your research of how the brothers felt about each other?
Yes, I did. You know, Tenskwatawa was a remarkable figure, certainly grossly underplayed in history and misunderstood. He was the greatest Indian prophet in American history, and among Native Americans, prophets and seers were highly respected and highly influential. Tenskwatawa, until he had this transformational vision, he was a dissolute, he was an alcoholic, a layabout, absolutely inept, of no worth as a warrior and hunter, which were roles that were expected of Shawnee men and of Indian men in the Midwest in general. He shot his eye out with a bow and arrow as a kid. But nevertheless, Tecumseh felt, you know, a deep sense of kinship with them. Perhaps that's a consequence of losing their mother and being perpetually on the move. And once Tenskwatawa had his vision and, you know, proclaimed the consequences of it, this call for spiritual rebirth, Tecumseh was one of his first acolytes, which is saying quite a lot because the brothers were polar opposites. Tecumseh was, from boyhood, a charismatic young man, a natural leader, drew followers to him quite readily, admirers both female and male. Yet he had a sense of proprietary interest in his brother's welfare. And during Tenskwatawa's early life, up until his early 30s, when he again had this vision, Tecumseh and his elder sister, who was then married, both provided for Tenskwatawa and his family. So there was considerable, you know, affection between the two, and Tecumseh readily accepted Tenskwatawa's doctrine and vision. And when Tecumseh expanded on this to include his call for unity against American encroachment, Tengswatawa supported that as well and incorporated that into his spiritual and cultural doctrine. So they got along quite well. I didn't really encounter any evidence of jealousy between the two. They seemed to work together very well, hand in hand.
My guest today is Peter Cousins. His new book is called Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. Peter, you talk in the book about how Tenskwatawa had followers among several tribes. Were these a natural pool from which Tecumseh could try to organize the Confederacy that we remember him best for?
Yes, it was. Unlike the tribes on the Great Plains, for instance, which were constantly at war with one another, even as they were fighting the United States in the years after the Civil War, the tribes in the modern Midwest got along very well, by and large, with one another. Although they did not all speak the same language, they were, for the most part, descended from Algonquin stock, had very similar cultural and spiritual beliefs. They were, unlike the tribes of the plains, they were sedentary or semi-sedentary people who lived in fixed villages, and they relied both on agriculture and hunting for their sustenance. And their numbers were not so great that they were impinging on one another. So it was not surprising that they gave Tecumseh and Tengswatawa an ear, just as earlier prophets from other tribes in the Old Northwest won adherence from fellow tribes. Like I said, these tribes were much more united and much more willing to cooperate than the tribes of the American West.
Part of the reason that the brothers' story is important to Michigan history is because of what Tecumseh had in mind for the end game, and that was a free state in the vicinity of Michigan for himself and, you know, of course, his followers, but for other tribes as well. How did his idea differ, do you think, from some other proposals for either reservation land or free unceded territories across the continent?
In a perfect world for Tecumseh, the whites would have been pushed out of Ohio and southern Indiana as well. But of course, that was unrealistic given the numbers in these areas. I mean, Ohio had already become a state by the time that Tecumseh was building his alliance. What he envisioned was a permanent homeland that was not negotiable. The United States government would exercise no influence, no control whatsoever over this land, and the Indians would not be compelled to follow any dictates of the U.S. government as they would if they were on reservation land or even if they were on unceded land, because just the word unceded carries with it the suggestion that it may eventually be ceded to the United States by treaty. But this would be land that would be inviolate and would be forever the domain of Native Americans, where they could live their traditional life of agricultural pursuits and hunting simultaneously.
Yeah.
But Tecumseh was not so naive as to believe he could do this without help, and that help would come from the British who controlled Canada.
It's interesting how the map in his head involved this sort of a buffer area between British and American territory. It sounds like he was quite skilled in thinking about the power dynamics that were going on between America and the UK at that point.
He was. He realized two things very early on, before the War of 1812 even occurred. He realized that he could not hope to succeed without British assistance, at a minimum, British supplied weapons and ammunition and other supply needs. Secondly, that he couldn't wage war against the United States successfully and with any assurance of victory without active British participation. So it was fortuitous for him that the War of 1812 broke out, and the British had similar needs. They needed Tecumseh and his alliance to have any chance of holding Western Ontario and preventing an American invasion of what was then considered Western Canada.
The War of 1812 finds Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa aligning with the British, and Tecumseh's forces were important in the battle that ultimately resulted in Detroit falling into British hands. But in 1813, the tide turns, and Tecumseh was killed by U.S. forces at the Battle of the Thames. Do you think there's a short answer for why the Confederation that Tecumseh was able to form through this vision that Tenskwatawa articulated, why the Confederacy didn't succeed in its aims?
To begin with, you know, the Tecumseh's Confederacy was the largest Confederacy ever created by Native Americans to resist American encroachment. It was, for instance, three times greater than the largest Pan-Indian alliance in the American West, which was that of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse in 1876. The problem inherent in any Indian alliance, and Tecumseh understood this, was that there were really no more democratic societies imaginable than those of the Indian tribes. An individual Indian could choose to follow a political or military leader, a chief, or not. And chiefs could follow an alliance leader so long as it benefited their interests. Tecumseh, just like lesser chiefs within tribes, really had no institutional means to compel their followers to follow their dictates, and they relied on success, on charisma, on persuasive powers to succeed. The short answer was, I think they would have succeeded had the British been able to provide sufficient assistance, both in terms of actual troops and also provisions and gunpowder. But the war turned against the British in that theater, largely because of events in France and their war against Napoleon Bonaparte. They simply could not detach enough troops to Canada to be able to defend the entire Canadian possessions effectively. And so it was a lack of British strength that really doomed Tecumseh and the Indians. And once it became apparent that the British were not going to be able to hold Western Ontario and prevent an invasion of Western Ontario, much less maintain Michigan, which they and Tecumseh had held for a year. Once that became apparent, supporters began to break away from Tecumseh.
After Tecumseh's death, Tenskwatawa continued to try to pursue a homeland, and so fell into negotiations with Lewis Cass, future governor of Michigan, who was no friend to Native people. I'll leave it to the book to tell that story, but it sounds like a situation in which he didn't have much of a chance given Lewis Cass's record.
Right. It's the concluding chapter of the book, and in some ways, to me, perhaps the most poignant to witness what happened to Tenskwatawa in the last three decades of his life after his brother was killed at the Battle of the Thames. It's quite tragic and quite poignant, and as you say, intimately involved Lewis Cass.
Peter, after Tecumseh's death, a lot of North Americans, and I think especially mainstream white society, places Tecumseh on something of a pedestal. And this really seems at odds with the fact that he represented something that the United States was actively trying to eradicate at the time. What do you take away from the simultaneous canonization of Tecumseh in American history? And I guess just the inability of the U.S. government even today to sort of figure out what to do with his request, just that people either, you know, be given to live freely or be given a place to live in which they exercised full sovereignty.
Tecumseh is if not unique, nearly so, in that the canonization of him began while the War of 1812 was still going on. It arose because at the Battle of Fort Meigs in northern Ohio, he single-handedly saved several hundred Kentuckians from torture and death at the hands of his own followers who wanted to put them all to death. And Tecumseh intervened and saved the lives of these several hundred Kentuckians. And when they were exchanged, they sang his praise to their fellow citizens, and word of Tecumseh's humanity spread rapidly, and he was seen as a term of the day, a noble savage, someone who fought by the white man's rules and was worthy of respect and admiration. As for what transpired subsequently, I can't speak authoritatively to what's happening today because, you know, I'm a historian. I look at the past, and I can't comment about events today with any more insight than anyone else. But I think, you know, historically speaking, the United States government never intended to pursue a policy of genocide. In fact, the word didn't even exist in those days. Not physical genocide, but certainly a cultural genocide in which they reckoned that given the enormous population in the United States, even in the 19th century, vis-a-vis the Indians, who never numbered more than a couple hundred thousand by this time, that it was inevitable that even with the best of intentions, treaties could not be maintained that allowed the American Indians large swaths of land. It just is beyond the ability of the government to control westward migration and prevent reoccurring encroachment on Indian lands. And consequently, the reservation lands that were accorded the Indians, with a few notable exceptions, were lands that were less than desirable, and the whites really would not have a great interest in intruding upon.
Peter Cousins, his latest book is Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. Peter, thank you so much for this book and for taking some time to tell us about it today. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I thank you for the chance to talk about it.